Fussel, Real 2. You were just saying about the trying to provoke the Germans in the Straits of Dover.
Yes, well, this was the part of the Exercise Harlequin where the our plan was to go across with these MTBs to see if we can get across to the Channel ports, Dunkirk, Calais, without being seen. But obviously such a short stretch of water, and we were detected, so we had to abort all these crossings. I believe one of the operations after Exercise Harlequin, they succeeded in getting across to Calais, but I wasn't on that one at all. We continued with our training from September 1943 right through to D-Day by going all round various terrain which could be a replica of the actual area where we were going to operate. We did a lot of our training around Chichester. We were stationed down at Seaford, and we had our brigade HQ at Cowdery House, but we had to do our training the same as each commander unit. Now, up till about March 1944, each commander unit did their commando training, and we in brigade HQ would participate in this brigade training. And we did training around the New Forest area, things like fire and movement. We used to go across in landing craft, and we'd land at Worthing, Angmering, onto the beaches. We'd move from there across the coastal road up towards Arundel. And our first objective during training was to cross the River Arun near Arundel, because I believe it was a very fast flowing water and there were no boats. We had to cross it by use of the commander training, rope and toggle. Well, there were one or two mishaps. There were people being swept into the water because the river at that time, at that particular time, this was March, April time, not only was it cold, but it was between 5 and 6 knots. You get caught into this, and you're carrying a rucksack, your rifle, or your personal weapon. If it was a rifle, it was 50 rounds of ammunition. You had a rucksack containing anything of upwards of 80 pounds of kit, and, your ammunition boots. And getting across this water was an arduous thing. It was like going through a commando course on its own. Across, up to Arundel, and Arundel Castle was the first objective. I mean, that was our target, although we never entered it, obviously, but that was our first target. And we had to reach that. And, of course, the whole ploy was that by the time we landed on the beach at 6 o'clock, we had to cross the river, which was later to become the River Orne-Carn Canal. And the high ground where Arundel Castle is located is the high ground at Amphiville and La Plan, which was to be our base for many weeks after D-Day. Now, we carried on with this training right up till the end of May 1944. At the end of May, we were told to leave because we were going to continue with our further training down in the Southampton area. When we got to these transit camps in the Southampton area, we had a pretty good idea that this was it, because once you got in, you weren't allowed out. We referred to them as concentration camps. I mean, they weren't in the true sense of it, but once you got in there, no way could you come out. Letters, you still could write letters, and you could post them in any post box inside the camp. The only trouble was they never left the camp till after D-Day. We were there for the best part of a week. During this week that we were in these transit camps at Southampton, we were then given the proper briefings. And this time, for the first time, every single manjack knew exactly where he was going, knew exactly what landing craft he was going to be on, knew where he was going to land, the name of the beach he was going to land, the people that he was going to have to the left and right of him, unless of course he was on the extreme left or the extreme right hand flank, the forces that were going to be in support of us, models of the area we were going to land at, hypothetical cases whereby, when I say hypothetical, they were assuming that certain gun batteries would be put out of action by the RAF or by naval bombardment, certain ground defences like machine gun posts and various other mines were going to be put out of action again by the RAF and bombardment from sea. We were told the armada that was going to assist us, there was going to be in excess of several thousand ships. We were going to have the Rodney, the Howe, the Nelson, the Roberts in our support. They're the four major British battleships afloat at that time. We were going to have several cruisers, rocket ships, flak ships, barrage balloons escorting us, so we wouldn't be dive-bombed if there was any enemy air attack. And we had all the information that we needed. In fact, more information that we needed, because we were told that the RAF were going to, or not the RAF necessarily, but the Allied Air Forces were going to put out the guns, and they were going to put out there was going to be no mines to worry about, and we were going to have a dry landing, and we were going to be taken up virtually to our first. I mean, this is the sort of impression we were getting, and we were getting a little bit alec-y-vic and saying, oh, come on, let's get over with it, let's go now. The actual landing was supposed to have taken place on the 5th. On Saturday, the 4th of June, we were getting ready to leave our transit camps to embark on the ships, which were now tied up alongside the various wharfs and jetties at Warsash. And at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were told, stand down, it's off. And we were given the reasons. They said the weather is broken, and it's unlikely that we shall be landing, certainly not for the next 24 hours. And they were going to make a decision by midday on Sunday. And every man, Jack, whatever his religion, all went to church. It didn't matter what denomination you were, whether you were agnostic, atheist, Church of England, Roman Catholic, Presbyterian, Jew, or you stood at some church and you were being blessed by someone. And we were told at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon that the postponement was only for 24 hours and that we would be embarking that evening. So we got all our weapons ready, weatherproofed and oil-proofed in case we had a wet landing. We got the ammunition ready, we got all our kit ready, and that's the rucksacks. And those that hadn't got automatic weapons, because the automatic weapons, like Bren guns and all that, they had an awful lot of ammunition to carry. So those that only had their own personal weapons, like I had a rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition, I had to carry 2 smoke generators. Others had to carry 3 mortar bombs. I had 2-inch or 3-inch mortar bombs, and this was all to assist the heavy weapons troop with the machine guns and mortars. Well, we moved out of camp, and we boarded our landing craft at Warsash. It was a landing craft infantry. This is the first time I'd ever been on one of them. It was one of these front ramp, unloading, loading type of vessels. And it looked nice. It looked like a river launch. We pulled out and we assembled in the Solent till about 7 o'clock when we joined a tremendous armada. There were ships carrying barrage balloons, there were flagships, there were rocket ships, there were destroyers hooting up and down, up and down, up and down. Corvettes, minesweepers, you name it, they were there. We left the Solent at about 9 o'clock. And we were told that we were going to have our last hot meal before hitting the beaches. And that was a tin of McConaughey's self-heating vegetable soup, and I must admit it tasted marvellous. We stayed up on deck as long as we could, for as long as we were allowed, actually, because once we started pulling off, there was radio silence, and you know, people had to be quiet, and they weren't allowed to do this. Meantime, there were about 2,000 ships, all with their engines chugging away and churning away, making a tremendous amount of noise, but they didn't want us up on board. So we had to go below decks, and of course the stench below decks was terrible. I mean, the smell of the diesel and all that sort of stuff, and plus the fact that once we got out into the mid-channel, the sea was pretty rough, and not being very good sailors, you know, we were violently ill down below, and I was breaking my neck to get up on deck, get a breath of fresh air, but we weren't allowed. Till about 5 o'clock in the morning, the gangway was opened up, and they said, all right, you can come out on deck now. It was lovely to smell fresh air. When we got up on deck, we looked across towards the beaches, and we could see nothing but ships. Hundreds of aircraft above, going in relays, strafing, bombing, using cannon fire, and the guns, we could hear the guns of the battleships and cruisers opening up, and we could see the flashes. Well, by about 5 o'clock, just after 5 o'clock, we went under the guns of the Roberts, that's the Dreadnought, the Rodney and Howe, they were pounding their guns, and there was another battleship there. And you can imagine the tidal wave that every time these salvos went off with these four enormous battleships. And it was tidal waves. And we got even more seasick by the movement of these waves, because we were getting awash with these lesser things. It was nearing 6 o'clock when we were given the order to get our kit on, get our weapons ready, and weapons loaded, one up the spout, ready for a landing. And of course, room is always, you know, we're going to have a dry landing, says one, so that's passed down the line. Somebody says, we've got a little bit of enemy opposition. Where did that come from? Oh, the naval rating over there has just heard it on the wireless. And of course, they were sort of listening into communications between flotillas, and some people were being fired at, others weren't. Well, we saw the outline of the coast. Aircraft were flying backwards and forwards, laying down smoke, so we couldn't see much inland, although we saw the outline of the coast. And we saw ships running in ahead of us, four commando, of which I was not part now, I'm at Brigade HQ at now. Four commando had gone in with the French commandos, of four commando and of ten commando. There were two French troops and ten commando. And they were allocated to four commando, and their task was to go into Wistrom, a direct assault on Wistrom. And they were to bottle up the extreme left-hand flank of the whole of the invasion fleet, force. We came in next with number six commando. Three commando and six commando landed together. 45 Royal Marine Commando landed on our right flank. That was our first brigade front, and that was on Sword Beach. We landed about a mile and a half to the west of Wistrom. We had, well, when I say an opposed landing, I mean, it wasn't like Dieppe, where the Germans were waiting for us on the beaches. There was shelling on the beach, because the guns at Merville, that were supposed to have been put out of action, went. and there were four guns in the battery there that were still firing at us. There were the big guns from Le Havre, right across the other side of the bay, with, I don't know, 14-inch, 15-inch guns. Each shell weighed a ton. That kept lobbing over one at a time. We had an awful lot of mortars from the villages behind Weestrom, Hermanville, Burneville, Granville. They were firing at us, and quite a lot of sniper fire was coming as well. The beaches were cleared to a certain extent of mines. By the time we landed, the Royal Naval beach clearance people had been in front of us, and they had cleared a narrow strip, and they'd taped the strip that had been cleared and declared safe, through which flail tanks were going. And this was a great support to us, because at least now we had something to hide behind, and if any snipers were available, well then we could pop them off from either side if we were able to see them. The battles were going on in Weestrom, and they were pretty well tied down by No. 4 Commando and also 3 Infantry Division, because we were in support of 3 Infantry Division. And there was already a brigade of 3 Infantry Division on shore. We clear the beaches straight after we hit them, and unfortunately some of the infantry units of one of the brigades who'd landed along with us, part of the infantry training I gathered at that time was to, you know, once you land, dig in. Well, that was not what we were taught in the commanders. Our idea was to get the hell out of it as quickly as you can, as fast as you can, and as far as you can. So one or two of our officers shouted these chaps and said, for God's sake, don't dig in here. You're going to get shelled and mortared. You're going to be counterattacked. For God's sake, get clear of the beach and get the other side of the road. Anyway, these chaps didn't know what to do. They followed us, which was probably just as well, because at least it made easier the people who were coming in behind us. It cleared the beaches for those people to land, bring in further supplies and all that sort of stuff without cluttering up the beaches with a lot of holes that filled in with sand anyway. We didn't have a dry landing, as we were first told. We had a very, very wet landing, because these landing craft that we were on, the LCIs, by the time they let their ramps down, we were in about 4 feet of water. And our coxswain said that he couldn't go any further, he said, because he'd struck one of these underwater spikes and was filling up the water. Well, we were lucky that it had only struck a barren spike, because most of these spikes had telemines on them. And the ships weren't so lucky, because it blew a hole in the bows when they struck. Anyway, we got on shore. We went across the first lateral coastal road, which was only a narrow road, and we got into a marshy area behind. Now that's when we were lobbed and had to get our heads down, because the mortars were picking us off then. But somebody in the crowd shouted out, we better get moving, because once they get targeted onto us, they were just trying it out for distance. Again, we were lucky. We had flail tanks that were moving up to our left and right, and we also had a Sherman tank about 100, 120 yards away to our right. And he was able to pick off where the known machine gun posts were, and he was engaging them with his tank fire, and very successfully too. So that left the smaller chaps, like the snipers and the people who we couldn't see, who were hidden in dugouts, and people who got caught being in areas where they shouldn't have been, and the night before. And they came out only too willing to give themselves up. We saw very little opposition till we reached Hermanville. We had a few snipers at Hermanville, but Lord Lovett, who was our brigade commander, whom we were following, said, don't worry about the opposition here, bypass it, the infantry will clear it up, because this is what they're here for. Our job is to meet up with the airborne on two bridges, and we haven't long to do it. It was now getting towards 11 o'clock, and we were still about 3-4 miles away from the bridges. Anyway, we bypassed the village of Hermanville, and at a fairly quick pace again, we were fairly well laden. We had our rucksacks, nearly 60 to 80 pounds each man was carrying, plus his personal weapon. We were wet from the waist down, with little hope of changing our clothes till we got to our destination, which were the high ground at Le Plan. We reached the bridges just after 12. We were due to reach them at 12 o'clock, and Major John Howard of the Parachute Regiment, who came in with the first fleet of gliders, met Lovett on the beach, on the bridge. And Lovett said something to the remark, or the famous remarks that he's alleged to have said, it was in the film The Longest Day. I'm sorry, John, we were late. I think it was 2 minutes past 12 or something. So it wasn't bad going, really. We had the best part of 4.5-5 hours to travel 12 miles. And I admit we went fighting all the way, but, you know, every now and again we had to take cover because there was the odd sporadic machine gun and odd sniper that kept hindering us, annoying us from time to time. Well, we got to these bridges, and they still had a little bit of opposition on the bridge at the Caen Canal, because there was a machine gun post that hadn't been put out of action, and he was causing an awful lot of problems on the right-hand side of the bridge. Now, the bridge is a metal bridge to allow the ships to pass through, and on either side of the bridge was like a wall, a metal wall, on which you could walk. There was a walkway on either side. Well, there was also a sniper who kept picking people off, but he could only keep picking one or two people off. When there was about 20 or 30 of us in a line, we made a dash along one side of the bridge behind this wall, so we were out of sight of the machine gunner from this machine gun post. Somebody from 6th Commando decided he'd had enough with this machine gun post, and he went in. How he got so close to the machine gun post and lobbed a grenade, don't ask me, I don't know. It's just one of these fantasies of war. He happened to be lucky enough to get, without being spotted, he got up to this machine gun post, he lobbed his grenade in, and obviously whoever the occupants were, it silenced them, and no more machine gun post. But this irritating little sniper that we had on the left-hand side was causing a little bit of problem. But by now, 12:15, the entire brigade could come through over the bridge. So they were able to virtually march across the bridge because there was no opposition there at all. The paras and glider pilots had seen to that, except for this one machine gun post. And there were a lot of bodies that we passed, poor chaps on the airborne and the paras. And I don't know, we left the sniper to get on with it. He wasn't going to hold an entire brigade up, so we knew he was going to run out of ammunition. And I think, thank God for us, the shooting wasn't particularly brilliant. If he was a sniper, sometimes I have my doubts. It could be a French sympathiser who... It could have been. I mean, it was known that they did have some sympathisers in that area. They'd been in there for 4 or 5 years. Anyway, we reached our first target at Le Plan and Amfreville. Four commando took up positions at a place called Hauger, H-A-U-G-E-R. We took up positions in Le Plan. Six commando took up positions at Amfreville. Three commando went with Peter Young to, oh dear, I can't think of the name of it, and 45 Royal Marine commando were charged with the task of putting out of action and silencing this gun battery at Merville. Well, they went in, but they got held up. They called for support, so three commando went in as well. So we had 45 Royal Marine commando and three commando. They went in, and Mobile battery itself was a bit of a mess, but two of the guns had been pounded pretty badly by the RAF, but there were still two guns that were operational. Anyway, they got put out of action and the crews were silenced with the help of, I think, five para-battalion, three commando, and 45 Royal Marine Commando. Anyway, at least it silenced those guns. So 45 Royal Marine Commando, they took up their positions, 6 Commando, 4 Commando, and 3 Commando. Brigade HQ being in the middle of the whole bank chute. And Brigade HQ, although it wasn't directly in the front line, we were all in trenches with a farmhouse as our headquarters. We were literally about 300 yards away from what you can call the front line. We had occasions when German patrols would come in behind us and, you know, drop one or two snipers off. And this harassment went on for about 2 or 3 days. We soon got used to it and we began to find out where their points of entry. So we used to lie in wait for them. And as soon as they'd come through, we'd pop them off. Because in those days, even today I suppose, we would have a code word each day and there would be a reply. Like, you might have eggs, the answer would be bacon, or bacon, the answer would be eggs. Fire, smoke, alternatives, things that, you know, we sort of use every day in the bread, butter, that type of thing. And these code words used to be issued every day. And it would be changed every day. Now, if anybody got caught, if one of our patrols got caught, and we knew that they knew the code words, then that code word for that particular day would be changed. And the people in the FDL would be told, the forward defense lines, they would be told, so watch out if anybody comes in. We had to be careful too with the people in the FDLs by changing these code words so often. Patrols sometimes used to go out, get caught coming back. Well, when I say get caught, get spotted coming back, and they'd lie low. And they may have to lie low till that night. Now, if they can't move out of that area, they would still lie low until it was safe enough to travel. If it was after midnight, then the code words changed again. Now, they didn't know the code word 2 days ahead. So the people in the FDL had to be very, very careful. And of course, the usual thing was revert to the old army slang. You know, somebody would get a challenge, like you get a code word come out from an FDL. And you'll have some bright spark. You know, he'll probably turn around and use some pretty strong expletives, which I won't use. But if you can get the sense of it, they'd be rather crude and cruel and vulgar.
Which the Germans would be
they would never they would they would they wouldn't know what it meant anyway. But we did have on occasions, well, once or twice I think, some of the Germans, they would dress up in American uniforms or even Canadian uniforms, which they'd captured at presumably Dieppe or any other place, and try and ilf in.